Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock. First on this week's program, Donald Trump appoints Carrie Lake to lead Voice of America. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on December 11th. Ever since Donald Trump won the presidency in November, and Carrie Lake lost a Senate seat, rumors and speculation have swirled about where the MAGA loyalist Lake may fit into the conservative ecosystem. White House Press Secretary, Newsmax anchor, ambassador to Mexico. All know. In a post Wednesday night on Truth Social, Trump announced that he was tapping Lake as the director of state-run media broadcaster Voice of America. In true Trump fashion, the president-elect's announcement contained a not-so-subtle shot at his new appointee. While lauding Lake's 20-year career in news media, Trump bragged that Arizona supported him, quote, by record margins, conspicuously omitting that the state rejected Lake at the same time. Here's what to know about Lake's appointment. What is Voice of America? The agency Lake is set to direct is an international broadcasting state media network funded by the federal government. Founded in 1942, VOA was created to counter Nazi propaganda during World War II by distributing unbiased news and information. Today, the network has a similar goal. It distributes news content in nearly 50 languages to affiliate stations around the world. And while you may never have heard of it, according to the network's website, more than 354 million people tune in weekly. Funded by Congress, VOA is part of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, a government agency that oversees all non-military U.S. international broadcasting. Still, the network has a firewall protected by the 1994 U.S. International Broadcasting Act, which prohibits the U.S. government from interfering in its news reporting. What will Lake do as Voice of America director? As director, Lake would, among other positions, oversee the network, which includes divisions in East Asia and the Pacific, South and Central Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The man Lake will be replacing, Michael Abramowitz, just started his position as director over the summer. Before working at VOA, Abramowitz was the president of the democracy nonprofit organization Freedom House. He also was the director of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and spent 24 years as a reporter and editor at the Washington Post. And while VOA director appointments don't require Senate confirmation, Lake's appointment isn't a shoo-in. Since 2021, only the 6-member International Broadcasting Advisory Board has had the power to approve or remove heads of the VOA. Members of the IBAB are appointed by the president and must be confirmed by the Senate. By law, no more than 3 members of the IBAB can be from the same political party. There are 3 Democrats currently on the board, including 2 whose terms aren't set to end until 2027. To become VOA director, Lake will need at least 1 Democrat to vote for her. What has the reaction been to Lake's appointment? Trump already has been in trouble with the network. During his previous administration, his pick to run the agency was accused of trying to turn VOA into the propaganda arm of the administration. A federal judge ruled that Trump's director had violated the First Amendment rights of its journalists. Happy to finally have a job, Lake expressed excitement for the position on social media Wednesday night. She said she can't wait to get started in chronicling America's achievements worldwide. While Arizona Republicans such as U.S. Representative-elect Abe Hamada congratulated Lake, others jokingly wondered how the forever candidate could serve as the governor, senator, and VOA director all at the same time. Next, a story written by Emily Holshouser of the Arizona Mirror and published on the New Times website on December 13th. Critics to Katie Hobbs, publish the death penalty report you killed. Several advocacy groups on Wednesday called on Governor Katie Hobbs to finish and release an investigation into the state's death penalty practices. In January 2023, after a series of botched lethal injections, Hobbs issued an executive order establishing a death penalty independent review commissioner to examine how the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry carried out executions and issue a report on its findings. Lethal injections are difficult to carry out, and many of them go poorly. In 2014, the state of Arizona executed Joseph Wood after 2 hours and 15 injections of an experimental two-drug cocktail. In 2022, after renovations and several attempts to purchase more lethal injection drugs, Clarence Dixon was executed after 40 minutes. Execution staff had to place an IV line in his groin. Dixon bled as he died. Hobbs hired retired federal magistrate Judge David Duncan to conduct the report. His investigation began in September 2023. Duncan's draft detailed the history of lethal injections in Arizona, which date back to 1992, and the numerous problems the state has had getting access to a supply of drugs to use for lethal injections. This impenetrable cloud of secrecy that cloaks the execution process is a byproduct of the desire and legislative command to protect the identity of the executioner, Duncan wrote in the draft. Unfortunately, the black hood that covered the person carrying out the execution has grown to a cement silo that shields nearly all aspects of execution procedures. It is this siloed environment that breeds the errors and flawed practices that hobble lethal injections. During his investigation, Duncan said, he interviewed roughly 40 to 50 people involved with the execution process and reviewed tens of thousands of ADCRR records. Within those records, Duncan found handwritten memos related to Wikipedia searches about lethal injection drugs and financial statements to one execution staff member who was paid $60,000 for 3 executions in 2022. Duncan wanted to interview executioners in person, he said, and view a dry run of the protocols to better understand the methods being used. ADCRR would not allow him to do so. Duncan's draft concluded that the only method of execution that would be quicker and more painless than lethal injection is a firing squad, something that is explicitly barred by state law. A dozen shooters targeting the silhouette of the heart placed immediately above the actual organ would result in an obliteration of that organ and an immediate cessation of its pumping function, thus depriving all cells in the body of the oxygen required to function, Duncan wrote. In late November, Hobbs abruptly fired Duncan, ended his investigation, and ordered that an internal investigation into execution practices and protocols by ADCRR Director Ryan Thornell would suffice. Your review has unfortunately faced repeated challenges, and I no longer have confidence that I will receive a report from you that will accomplish the purpose and goals of the executive order that I issued nearly 2 years ago, Hobbs wrote in an email to Duncan. Under Director Thornell's leadership, ADCRR has undertaken a comprehensive review of prior executions and has made significant revisions to its policies and procedures. Executions back on. Hobbs' office has provided media outlets with 12 pages of a draft report written by Duncan, in addition to ADCRR's repudiation of his work and its own internal review, but has not made any of those documents available to the general public. Governor Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays told us that they had serious doubts about whether the state could carry out executions humanely, and that a thorough and independent review was necessary before executions were resumed in the state. Jared Keenan, the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Arizona, said during a press conference at the state capitol on Wednesday. Yet, Governor Hobbs has now decided to dismiss Judge Duncan and complete an internal review of the state's execution protocols, rather than allow the public to see a completed report. Duncan's draft, which concludes that lethal injection is not a viable method of execution in actual practice, is an unfinished outline of the report. It was originally meant to be finished this month. I don't know whether it was a shift in the political winds or if they were no longer interested in waiting, Duncan said. With Duncan's independent review axed and the internal review completed, the Hobbs administration has now nothing blocking it from pursuing executions for some of the 111 people sitting on death row in Arizona. The first person likely to face a lethal injection is Aaron Gunches, who was convicted in 2002 for murdering Ted Price, an ex-boyfriend of Gunches' girlfriend. Gunches kidnapped Price and killed him in a desert area near the Beeline Highway. Gunches was not immediately imprisoned. In 2003, during a traffic stop, Gunches shot an Arizona Department of Public Safety officer twice and fled the scene. He was arrested a day later in Wendon after a massive manhunt. In 2022, Gunches represented himself and asked for the Arizona Supreme Court to expedite his execution. He withdrew that request in 2023, but a lengthy legal battle played out between Hobbs and Mays over Gunches' death warrant. Now, with the legality of executions clearer, Mays has requested another execution warrant for Gunches. It's unclear exactly what will happen next, but advocates say they want transparency. What it ultimately comes down to is that Governor Hobbs, the Department of Corrections, and Attorney General Mays are saying, "Trust us," said Katie Gibson McLean, a defense attorney who represented the nonprofit organization Arizona Attorneys for Criminal Justice at the press conference. "That's not good enough. We insist on proof." Sinema delivers a last fuck you to Democrats on her way out the door. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on December 12th. Just days away from her U.S. Senate exit, controversial Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema delivered a final blow to the party that she has consistently screwed over and abandoned. After missing a series of votes, Sinema finally showed up for work Wednesday to vote on a potential nominee for the National Labor Relations Board, which protects workers' rights. And, right on trend, Sinema's decision torpedoed Democratic plans. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, hoped to nominate Lauren McFerrin, the NLRB's current chair, to another five-year term. That would ensure the five-member board included three pro-union Democrats through at least 2026, covering the first 2 years of Donald Trump's second term. But of all the days to finally pop into work, Sinema chose Wednesday, voting to deny McFerrin's nomination alongside fellow swing voter and Democrat-turned-independent Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Both Sinema and Manchin are leaving the body after this year. The nomination failed by one vote. If McFerrin had been confirmed, Democrats would have had control of the board until 2026. Several unions expressed disappointment in Sinema's vote. The local chapter of Unite Here, which represents hospitality workers in the state, blasted Sinema in a statement. "Once more, she has chosen to turn her back on the working people who elected her," the organization said in a statement provided by spokesperson Victoria Stahl. "It's a sad day for working people in Arizona and across the nation." April Verrett, the president of the Service Employees International Union, called the move a missed opportunity to ensure the NLRB remains an impartial agency. Meanwhile, anti-cinema organizations and other Arizonans have expressed a lack of surprise, but continuing disappointment at the senator's actions. Senator Kyrsten Sinema has missed every vote since the Thanksgiving break, but came back today to vote against workers, one social media user wrote. Class act. You won't be missed. The Replace Sinema PAC, which worked to remove Sinema from office, was unsurprised by the news on social media. Thanks, Kyrsten, the organization wrote. This is exactly why we voted you out. Quiet quitting. Sinema's popularity has been tanking for several years. One-time supporters and Democrats are unhappy about her refusal to vote to get rid of the filibuster, the viral thumbs-down moment to scuttle a minimum wage increase, and her eventual decision to leave her party. Sinema was once even followed into a bathroom at Arizona State University by angry constituents. In March, reading the tea leaves of a likely primary challenge by Representative Ruben Gallego, Sinema announced that she wouldn't be running again. Gallego handily beat Republican challenger Kerry Lake to take Sinema's seat. Since that "you can't fire me, I quit" moment, Sinema has essentially quiet quit her job in the Senate. Her Senate attendance has tanked since April, and according to GovTrack, she's missed a third of roll call votes taken since the spring. Her attendance ranks near the bottom of her colleagues in the Senate. This week alone, she failed to attend three votes to confirm district court judges. Before voting to neuter the NLRB, the last time Sinema voted was before Thanksgiving, when she voted to confirm Sharad Harshad Desai as a U.S. district judge in Arizona. But while she's been absent from votes, Sinema has used the remainder of her campaign money on trips to France, Japan, and the United Kingdom. Between September and July, her campaign billed $216,000 for her travel. Her campaign also paid another $152,000 for security-related expenses. Phoenix New Times asked Sinema's office why she hasn't been showing up to votes and why she voted against McFerrin's nomination, despite previously supporting her nomination in 2020. Her office has not responded. Still not bothering to do her job right up until the very end, wrote the Replace Sinema PAC on social media. We love this for her. Next, a story written by Zach Buchanan and posted on December 11th. State Senator files bill to curb the unlawful release of balloons. The next legislative session hasn't even begun yet, but state lawmakers have gotten a head start on proposing legislation for 2025. Among the early bills to attack some of Arizona's weightier issues is one that is, well, lighter than air. Senate Bill 1004, sponsored by Republican State Senator John Kavanaugh, is intended to curb the unlawful release of balloons. Should it pass, it would bar any adult from intentionally releasing 10 or more balloons filled with lighter-than-air gas. A violation would be considered a petty offense and carry a fine. Exceptions are made for meteorological balloons, hot air balloons, and balloons released indoors. So, all those gender reveal parties that flood the skies with pink and blue dots, consider them on notice. They wouldn't be able to do that, Kavanaugh said in a phone interview with Phoenix New Times. They'd have to find some other way to release their gender position, or they could just get long string and pretend they did it. Balloon safety has not been a long gestating issue for Kavanaugh, who represents a district that includes parts of North Scottsdale. It only came to his attention after he began receiving several automated emails from groups asking him to address the issue. Initially, he said, it didn't really make too much sense to me for Arizona. But then he spoke to the cattle ranchers. Kavanaugh said that cattle rancher organizations in California pushed for a similar law because farm animals sometimes consume down balloons. Indeed, California has a law outlawing the release of Mylar balloons, which carries a misdemeanor penalty. Kavanaugh said he consulted with members of the Arizona Cattle Growers Association about an Arizona version of the law, adding that the text of the law is more or less unchanged from how it was submitted to him by groups lobbying for the law. Arizona Cattle Growers Association President Mike Geneseo said that he hasn't spoken with Kavanaugh about the bill, nor read its text, and is hesitant to offer an opinion. But he did say that it's not uncommon for livestock to be killed after ingesting balloons that fall to the ground. I have stuff that flies on my ranch all the time, and I do have cattle that die from it from time to time, Geneseo said. My calves, they're like puppies. They're curious, and they have to play with everything, especially if it's not what they normally see. I hate seeing them. Geneseo hasn't had issues with commercially available balloons, but he did have one cow die after ingesting a weather balloon that fell on his ranch north of Kingman. He said he's found 4 or 5 meteorological balloons, which are accepted under Kavanaugh's proposed bill on that ranch. I hate seeing them come out there. It drives me crazy, Geneseo said, though he added that, I don't know if I would go to the legislature and ask them to work on a law to ban them. Kavanaugh's law is broader than California's. All balloon types are covered, not just those constructed of electrically conducive material, which California bans, and also less severe. Kavanaugh said he lowered the proposed penalty to just a fine rather than a misdemeanor. Even though Democrats are big into the environment with their total aversion to the prison pipeline, I knew if I kept it as a crime, they'd all vote against it, he said. I think it serves the same educational and deterrent function. Kavanaugh feels good about his bill's chances of passing. He sponsored plenty of controversial bills before, including a redo for next year of his 2024 bill, attempting to bar transgender people from using the bathrooms that match their gender identities. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed that bill once and will likely do so again if the 2025 version passes. But Kavanaugh expects the balloon bill to float through the process. Once I get environmentalists and the cattle industry for it, it's going to pass, he said. He won't be deflated by the jokes he knows he's going to get along the way. I will no doubt get some jokes made about me and hot air balloons and what have you. But that comes with the turf, Kavanaugh said. All publicity is good, unless you're in handcuffs, in this game. A Phoenix-Tucson train route inches toward reality. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on December 9th. A passenger rail service between Phoenix and Tucson took a small step forward toward reality last week, although it still has a long way to go before trains are yo-yoing between the two Arizona cities. On Friday, the Arizona Department of Transportation announced the formation of an executive leadership team to nudge the long simmering project down the tracks. The group consists of representatives from the governor's office, ADOT, the Maricopa Association of Governments, Pima Association of Governments, and the Sun Corridor Metropolitan Planning Organization. It will be years until any track is laid, if it happens at all. Until then, here's what you need to know about the project. Where would the train go? The passenger train, operated by Amtrak, would cover a 160-mile route between the Phoenix and Tucson areas. The route, which would run partly parallel to Interstate 10, was chosen in 2016. The train would make 3 round trips a day, traveling at speeds up to 79 miles per hour. Starting in Tucson, the train would travel along I-10 until Eloy, then dart north to run through Queen Creek, Tempe, and Phoenix, before ending in Buckeye. A one-way trip would take just less than 2 hours and 30 minutes, with stops in downtown Phoenix, Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, Tempe, Coolidge, and more. The newly announced leadership team will work to determine where the train should stop and how many stops it will make based on travel demand and feasibility, factoring in the locations of critical facilities, such as airports and colleges. It's possible Amtrak will seek to extend the route beyond its two endpoints, going as far west as Los Angeles and as far east as New Orleans. When could it be finished? The real question is, when will the project really start? The passenger rail line between the two cities has been in some stage of development since at least 2011. The current planning phase alone won't wrap up until mid-2027 at the earliest. There are hurdles. Earlier this year, Republican lawmakers wanted to stop the train in its tracks. Republicans, including Senator Jake Hoffman, attempted to pass a bill to squash the project, arguing that no one would ride the passenger rail and that it would be a waste of money. The bill passed the state Senate, but died in the House. However, if a bill to kill the project had reached the desk of Governor Katie Hobbs, she likely would have vetoed it. One of her first actions in office was securing $3.5 million in one-time funding to develop a service plan for the passenger rail project. Investing in passenger rail between Phoenix and Tucson holds enormous promise for economic growth and employment, and would mean more transportation options for more Arizonans, Hobbs said in an ADOT press release. What still needs to be done? So far, no funding has been set aside to construct a line in the Phoenix-Tucson passenger rail corridor. All funding up to this point has been for plans and studies. Aside from the $3.5 million Hobbs secured, the Federal Railroad Administration awarded ADOT a grant of $500,000, which was used to complete a proposed scope, budget, schedule, and plan steps for creating a service development plan. In other words, they've planned for how to create the plan. The leadership team will work on identifying needed infrastructure improvements, such as additional tracks and maintenance facilities, and forecast ridership and revenue. These studies will help to identify the cost of the passenger rail service and what train services will be the most beneficial. ADOT hopes the FRA will approve the plan for the plan by spring of 2025. At that point, the project will enter the real planning phase, seeking approval through stakeholder and public engagement. This step is expected to start in mid-2025 and to take 2 to 3 years. Then, around summer 2027 or 2028, based on approval by the FRA, ADOT will conduct preliminary engineering and environmental analysis for the project. If all goes well, construction of a rail line between Tucson and Phoenix may finally begin. Writer Stephen Lemons brings us this next story, posted on December 9th. Victim rights advocate Rachel Mitchell went easy on pedophile coach. In the early 2000s, Kaylee Kozak was sexually abused by Joshua Jacobson, her physical education teacher and soccer coach at Liberty Elementary in Buckeye. At the time, she was 12 and 13 years old. As an adult, she pushed to pass legislation that became known as Kaylee's Law, which allows victims of certain sexual crimes to obtain lifetime injunctions against their abusers. Now, 2 decades after her abuse, Kozak is fighting another battle in court. In a lawsuit filed in Maricopa County Superior Court in November, Kozak says the Liberty Elementary School District ignored complaints about her abuser before police arrested him. Kozak's lawsuit also slams the prosecutor, who gave Jacobson a sweetheart plea deal. The prosecutor is none other than Republican Maricopa County attorney Rachel Mitchell, who was the sex crimes division chief for the county prosecutor's office at the time. Mitchell is not a party to the suit, and the county attorney's office did not respond to her request for comment. Kozak's attorney, William Fishbach, declined an interview request on behalf of his client. But Kozak clearly feels Mitchell, the Liberty Elementary School District, and the criminal justice system in general did not do right by her. Kozak is suing the district for compensatory and punitive damages. The suit does not mention a dollar amount, but a notice of claim to the district asked for $10 million. Kozak's lawsuit was spurred by revelations she found in the report of the Buckeye Police Department's investigation into Jacobson, which the suit says Kozak didn't receive until January of this year. The suit claims Mitchell had never given Kozak a copy of the report, and that it was only recently that Kozak realized she'd never seen it. What Kozak saw shocked her. Despite Mitchell's insistence that the case against Jacobson was weak, the suit says the police report indicated that Jacobson's predatory conduct was known to the school district and that multiple children and parents corroborated Kozak's allegations against Jacobson. Parents told police that they reported this misconduct in 2002 and 2003 to a principal for Liberty Elementary. According to the police report, the parents said the school's principal downplayed the incidents, with one parent saying the principal insinuated all the kids were lying. They knew, the suit says. Liberty Elementary School knew. They knew about Jacobson before he sexually abused Kozak. Let off easy? According to the lawsuit, Jacobson's infatuation with Kozak was a poorly concealed secret to students and parents at Liberty Elementary, one of seven schools in a district that serves 4,500 students in Buckeye and Goodyear. Students told investigators that Jacobson would look down girls' shirts while they were doing push-ups in gym class, and that he would pat girls on their butts. One parent claimed to have witnessed this behavior as it was occurring in a class of 20 to 25 girls. Two students noted that Jacobson especially lavished compliments and attention on Kozak. But when police questioned then-Liberty principal Nancy Bogart, she defended Jacobson and dismissed one allegation against him that she said turned out to be nothing. She claimed that there had been no formal complaint and no investigation. The principal also characterized one of Jacobson's accusers as a rumor spreader and part of a group of girls that like to stir up trouble. Asked about the protocol in place to deal with such matters, the principal called in the school district's then superintendent, Pete Turner, who said that he was unaware of any formal policy for handling allegations of teacher impropriety, though the lawsuit maintains there was a written policy in place at the time. Bogart and Turner are not named as defendants in the suit. They could not be reached for comment. Jacobson abused Kozak in 2002 and 2003, but police did not investigate Jacobson until after Kozak enrolled at Xavier College Preparatory Academy in Phoenix, where she reported the abuse to a counselor. Buckeye police then set up a confrontation call with Jacobson, during which he admitted to fondling Kozak's breasts and forcing kisses on her, leading to his arrest. In 2007, Jacobson pleaded guilty to one count of sexual abuse against a minor under 15, and one count of luring a minor for sexual exploitation, both Class 3 felonies. The deal stipulated that the then 32-year-old would receive no more than 3 years in prison, though he was ultimately sentenced to only 9 months in jail, with lifetime probation. When Jacobson was sentenced, Mitchell was the sex crimes chief for the county attorney's office. According to the lawsuit, Mitchell told Kozak's parents that the case against Jacobson was, quote, weak. So, Mitchell would offer a lenient plea agreement to incentivize Jacobson to plead guilty and thereby allow Mitchell to avoid trial. The suit states that Mitchell sold the idea of lifetime probation to Kozak and her parents as being truly lifetime, leading to a rude surprise when Jacobson asked a court to end it. The complaint also alleges that Jacobson's defense attorney had worked with Mitchell previously at the county attorney's office. The stress of reopening old wounds moved Kozak to push for Cayley's Law, which was signed into law by Governor Doug Ducey in 2021. Though Kozak appeared at a 2022 press conference held by Mitchell to ballyhoo Cayley's Law, the two reportedly fell out in 2023 over another Kozak-backed law, and Kozak was disinvited from being the keynote speaker at a victims' rights conference in Phoenix. Earlier this year, Kozak endorsed Mitchell's GOP primary rival, Gina Godbehere, whom Mitchell handily beat en route to a 9-point general election victory. Kozak's lawsuit makes a point of stating that despite Mitchell's history of publicly attacking Kozak, Kozak filed her complaint on November 7th, 2 days after the general election, to circumvent any claims from Mitchell that Kozak sought to harm Mitchell's re-election bid. Secret recording. The lawsuit makes explosive allegations about current Liberty Elementary School Board President Brian Parks. The suit references a recording of Parks made by an unnamed parent after the district had been served with Kozak's notice of claim, in which he allegedly downplayed the seriousness of Kozak's abuse. Kozak's suit describes Parks as laughing, stating of the notice of claim, "This is it? I mean, I don't want to minimize it, but it's like, really?" He adds, "I expected to see penetration, or this, or that." The recording was recently posted to The Truth About Liberty Elementary School District Number 25, a private Facebook group. In the recording, a male speaker identified by the post as Parks calls himself one of the top officials in the school district. He then describes reading the notice of claim. "As board members, because we're defending the school district, I have everything," he says. "I was reading through it, and I'm just like, this seems a little over the top for what happened." He added, "What I see here is a lot of somebody who is not willing to put it behind them and move on in life. It's sad to me." In emails to Phoenix New Times, Parks said the quotes were from edited recordings that had been taken out of context. According to Parks, some of the quotes were referencing different, more recent incidents in the school related to student-on-student violence. Parks also claimed that his private phone conversations with my wife, close friends, and family had been edited and posted all over social media. He wrote, "I have never heard these recordings. I don't know who recorded them, and quite a bit is not something I would say publicly to anyone." About the quotes referenced in the lawsuit, he wrote, "I disavow the entire transcription." Parks noted he joined the board in 2021, while Kozak's complaint regarded abuse that occurred more than 20 years ago. "It was not my intention to downplay anything," Parks wrote. "This is a serious accusation. I have zero tolerance for any sexual assault of any kind." He added, "I have great respect and admiration for Mrs. Kozak. I'm horrified by what took place." In a follow-up phone conversation, Parks said his previous cell phone had been compromised and was now in the hands of the FBI. He complained of people going through his garbage and calling Child Protective Services on him, which he blamed on disgruntled employees and others. "We're making huge changes," Parks said, "and some people do not like it. The district and its governance are sources of community contentiousness. The private Facebook page about the school district is rife with criticism of Parks and the district's current superintendent, Court Monroe, who took office this year. Monroe was the subject of controversy at a recent meeting of the district board, which voted 3-2 to increase a performance-based bonus to up to 20% of his base pay of $185,000. Monroe did not respond to a request for comment. A day in eviction court, where the Valley housing crisis wrecks lives. This next piece, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times, was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on December 10th. The week of Thanksgiving, 67-year-old Phoenix resident Juanita sat at the end of the third pew in the downtown Phoenix Arcadia Biltmore Justice Court, engulfed in nervous anticipation. She clutched her small beige purse as she stared straight ahead, listening to Judge Pro Tempore Alexia Cedillo call the cases of defendant after defendant. In a few minutes, she'd learn if her family still had a place to live. Just days earlier, Juanita received an eviction notice on the front door of her two-bedroom detached apartment in which she's lived for 7 years. Inside, the space is cramped. Juanita shares a bed with her daughter, while her sister, who is disabled and can't work, sleeps in the other bedroom. Juanita, who asked that her last name not be used to protect her privacy, isn't alone. Through November, there have been 79,858 eviction filings this year in Maricopa County, which is on track to break a record set in 2005. 13 out of every 100 renters in Phoenix have had eviction proceedings brought against them, according to Princeton University's Eviction Lab. Only two major cities, New York and Houston, have seen more eviction filings than Phoenix. In Arizona, the problem continues to grow. The number of eviction filings has increased since the COVID-19 pandemic, and Maricopa County just missed breaking its eviction record last year. The causes of the crisis are myriad: Arizona's low housing stock, and especially its lack of affordable housing, rapidly rising rents, stagnant wages, and inequities in the court system all contribute. The pandemic exacerbated every single one of them. The numbers are going up, and they're tragically high right now, but it's been pretty bad for a long time, said Drew Schaefer, the executive director of the William E. Morris Institute for Justice, which focuses on protecting the rights of low-income Arizonans. In the Valley, the crisis plays out daily in the county's 26 justice courts. Month after month, thousands of residents pile into courtrooms and video conference rooms, hoping to keep a roof over their heads and keep the constable at bay. Often, they have no one to help them through the process. Just as often, their landlords win. A worsening crisis. It wasn't always this bad. From 1990 to 2024, household incomes in Phoenix increased by 90%. But that significantly lags behind home prices. They've ballooned by a whopping 432% over the same period, according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Now, Arizona is a hotspot for housing unaffordability. The Arizona Department of Housing says the state is about 270,000 homes short of what it needs to meet demand. Two-thirds of that housing gap specifically affects low-income renters. Per the Arizona Research Center for Equity and Sustainability, the state is more than 183,000 affordable housing units short. With low supply and high demand, rents have unsurprisingly skyrocketed, rising nearly 72% over the last decade. Today, the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Phoenix is $1,328 a month. To afford that, meaning to spend no more than 30% of one's income on housing, tenants must make $53,112 per year, according to Apartments.com. Here's the problem. In Phoenix, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, roughly 30% of households make less than $50,000 a year. In fact, nearly half of renters cannot comfortably afford their rent. These tenants are cost-burdened, with many spending between 50% to 80% of their income on rent, instead of the recommended 30%. The rents are too high for families and households to be able to sustain, Schaefer said. They're spending a disproportionate amount of their resources on rent and housing costs. And that's why, when they have a temporary financial emergency, they end up facing eviction. But for one small twist of fate, Catherine Wilkins knows that that could be her. The 65-year-old pays $1,080 a month to rent a West Phoenix studio apartment. A back injury prevents her from working, so she lives off her monthly $1,400 disability check. That means more than 77% of her income goes to housing. Despite living in a low-income senior housing complex, Wilkins has seen her rent continue to rise, while her disability check never gets any bigger. Plenty of renters are in a similar position. While incomes in Phoenix did rise by 32% from 2010 to 2022, rents rose by more than double that amount during the same period. That puts tenants in a precarious spot, squeezing costs to make ends meet. To cut costs, Wilkins often seeks meals at a local food bank. She's stopped buying meat because she can no longer afford it. For a money-strapped renter, one disaster could quickly lead to eviction. If a child gets sick, a car is totaled, or a job is lost, the homes could be next. It's a mess for us out there, Wilkins said, and I'm not the only one who goes through this. So far, Wilkins has avoided an eviction notice, but Juanita has not been so fortunate. Like Wilkins, Juanita's badly hurt her back in an accident. She needs trigger point injections and is unable to work. Her Social Security hasn't kicked in yet, leaving her without a source of income and unable to pay rent for the last 3 months. As she awaited her name to be called in court, she owed $4,424.25 in unpaid rent, utilities, and late fees. When it rains, it pours, she said. I still live in fear. As she waited to hear her name, Juanita held on to the smallest glimmer of hope. Not every eviction filing results in an eviction, but in the eviction process and even before it, almost all of the power resides with the landlord. For low-income renters, the threat of eviction constantly looms. When a notice does appear, it begins a 2 to 3 week legal process that can be incredibly stressful for tenants. Evictions, though, don't tell the whole story, which is why the eviction lab looks at filings rather than judgments. Though Arizona Multi-Housing Association spokesperson David Leibowitz said about a third of filings are settled outside of court, eviction lab research specialist Grace Hartley says informal evictions, those occurring through a substantial rate increase or threats by landlords, are also common. Eviction Lab estimates that for every one formal eviction, 2 informal evictions occur. Even if someone is not necessarily being evicted by a sheriff, people are still being displaced, Hartley said. Simply filing against someone is a very stressful and traumatic event that leads to a lot of negative outcomes, both financially and in terms of health. 2.5 years ago, Wilkins experienced an informal eviction. She was living in a Peoria apartment complex and paying about $800 a month. But each year, her rent increased. Soon, the same apartment cost Wilkins $1,400 a month, which she couldn't afford. Instead of trying to scrape by and face eviction, Wilkins left to live with her daughter. I felt like I was being bullied out, she said. I came very, very close to being evicted. I still live in fear of that today. Wilkins had somewhere else to go, but many others do not. They stay in their lease, but start missing payments, hoping to scrape things together in time to stave off homelessness. When they don't, they find themselves in eviction court. Unsurprisingly, Maricopa County's homelessness problem and evictions problem share root causes. According to Pam Bridge, the Director of Advocacy and Litigation for the nonprofit law firm Community Legal Services, 80% of tenants in court wind up there after they received a 5-day eviction notice for failure to pay rent. In those situations, Arizona is hardly atypical. Per the legal site NOLO, 52% of states give tenants 5 days or less to pay up after an eviction notice. Experts say the entire process, from notice to suitcases on the curb, can take as little as 2 to 3 weeks. Eviction court can be a busy place, although it may not appear so at first glance. On the day of her hearing, Juanita was one of 4 people in the Arcadia Biltmore Justice Courtroom. The other 3 were Judge Cedillo, a court staffer, and 1 other tenant facing eviction. The rest of the packed docket was filled by people joining the proceedings virtually. The Arcadia Biltmore Justice Court covers Central and East Phoenix, and is the 5th busiest of Maricopa County's justice courts, according to court data. More than 320 evictions were filed in the precinct in November, and the court has seen 3,870 filings so far this year. As Cedillo called the names of plaintiffs and defendants, almost all of the landlords were represented by Colin Clark from Clark and Wheeler PC, who attended court via Zoom. Clark declined to comment for this story. By contrast, many tenants didn't attend the hearing at all, and none of those who did, by Zoom or in person, had legal representation. Only a few had a way of paying their outstanding balances. As Juanita waited her turn, tenant after tenant spelled out the circumstances that brought them to court. One man, who was awoken for court by his mother on Zoom, an interaction that was broadcast in the courtroom, begged for understanding as he explained that a series of personal and family situations had left him unable to pay rent. Another woman joined the Zoom call from her car and explained that she had just moved from Oregon after escaping a domestic violence situation. Her apartment was crawling with bugs, and her landlord wouldn't accept third-party payment from organizations who were trying to get her back on her feet. Circumstances such as pest infestation would have been grounds for a claim under Arizona's Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. But now it was too late. Because eviction proceedings are considered a simple breach of contract instead of a loss of home and safety, Cedillo couldn't consider those factors. In both cases, she ruled in favor of the landlord, setting a date for when a constable would remove both residents. If the woman had acted earlier, Cedillo informed her, the Landlord and Tenant Act may have protected her. "I don't know the law," the woman responded. "Few tenants have anyone to call upon who does." An unfair process. Like every other tenant in court that day, Juanita did not have a lawyer. Legal resources for tenants facing eviction are available, but there aren't enough of them. Community Legal Services offers representation for low-income tenants for civil proceedings, with a staff of about 25 attorneys and paralegals who prioritize cases through a triage system. Ones with a legitimate defense, such as a landlord failing to make necessary repairs, go to the top of the list. CLS also negotiates with landlords to give tenants more time to pay. The organization has a tenant eviction assistance project that helps tenants regardless of income. It's funded in part by Phoenix and Maricopa County, though the city funding will run out at the end of December. Other services, such as rental assistance programs, are sparse at best, as the state no longer funds them to any significant degree, Schaefer said. CLS's goal is to keep an eviction off a tenant's record, even if it means negotiating an out-of-court solution. An eviction record can lead to loss of housing vouchers and damaged credit, and can even make it more difficult to secure a job. Unfortunately, the majority of tenants walk into court with no lawyer. Can you pay? Roughly 45 minutes into the 9 a.m. proceedings, Cedillo summoned Juanita. Representing her landlord, Clark explained how much Juanita owed. "Do you owe this rent?" Cedillo asked her. "Yes," Juanita responded. "Can you pay it?" Cedillo asked. "The money isn't on me," she said, searching through her purse. "But I can today." Cedillo motioned Juanita to approach the bench and explained that she would hold off on making a judgment until 4:30 p.m. that day. Juanita would have until then to make a verified payment through cashier check or money order to her apartment complex. Otherwise, Cedillo would sign the judgment and put Juanita one step closer to eviction. Juanita signaled that she understood. She'd make the payment. As she exited the courtroom, Juanita was confident but rattled. She said her husband of 40 years, who had been in Texas for the last 6 months caring for a sister fighting cancer, was coming back into town. He'd be able to help. "If I didn't know the money was coming, I would have panicked," she said. "My husband has the money, so we are just going to pay it all out." The idea of emptying their home on such short notice seemed an impossible task. "We have so much stuff," she said. "We can't get it out so soon." But the 4:30 p.m. deadline passed, and Juanita had not submitted a payment. Cedillo signed the judgment in favor of the landlord, setting a date less than 2 weeks from her first eviction notice for her family to vacate the apartment. If they didn't, a constable would remove them. That date came earlier this month, on December 1st, as Arizonans shopped for holiday gifts, took their children to see Santa, and began counting the days until Christmas, Juanita was required to abandon her home. The latest casualty of Phoenix's eviction epidemic. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. Remember that if you missed any of the stories on this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen.